It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, right, wrong, and religion. We'll talk about different views of morality and ethics throughout history and from the different perspectives of different religious traditions and fields of study. With me this hour, Webb Keene. He's the George Herbert Mead Collegiate Professor of Anthropology at the University of Michigan. He's also the author of Ethical Life, Its Natural and Social Histories. He'll be speaking at Grinnell College tonight at 7:30 as part of a series on Rethinking Global Cultures. Hello, Webb.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Charity.
Also with us today, Robert Cargill. He's Assistant Professor of Classics and Religious Studies at the University of Iowa and the author of The Cities That Built the Bible. Hello, Bob.
Hi, Charity. Good to be here.
Yeah, welcome back to the show. And Webb, I want to start with you. From the perspective of an anthropologist who studies humans and human culture and society, would you say that an ethical code is something that all human cultures share?
Well, I would say that what I call the ethical stance is something that all humans are prone to. And the reason I'm calling it an ethical stance is because the way I've been thinking about it, a code is something more specific that only arises in particular times and particular places. So the basic idea is humans are prone to make ethical judgments and to pursue ethical values. That gets codified in particular historical circumstances. I could say more about that, but that's the short answer. So the answer, so to put it in one word, yes.
And you make very clear in your book that when we talk about an ethical stance or an ethical code, that doesn't imply that human beings are always good.
No, quite the contrary. A sad experience has taught us that this isn't the case. But even people who are, let's say, not good, are usually aware of the ways in which their actions run against the ideas of good that the people around them have. They're often the one example that I think we could think of is someone who tries to inflict pain on harm in another, on another person, can only do so if they understand what pain and harm are. If you intentionally set out to do it, otherwise you wouldn't even know how to proceed.
So even when someone violates what we might call an ethical code, it's evidence of an understanding of ethics.
I think that's quite right, yes.
What was it that got you interested in thinking about ethics as someone who studies human behavior and human culture?
Well, I was very interested, as an anthropologist, I'm very interested in human variation and the contrasts among different communities and different societies. And I had done extensive research in a society that was undergoing a fairly dramatic transition from a very traditional kind of what we could call religious practices, ritual relationships to the ancestor spirits, and they're undergoing a process of conversion to Dutch Calvinist Protestant Christianity. And I was fascinated by the contrast between the world that they were moving out of and the world they were moving into, and people's ability to change in some ways and resist change in others. And in particular, the sense of the ethical drive to transform oneself is fascinating. The question is, why don't you just keep going the way you've always been going? Why should you seek to change yourself when there's no obvious economic or material advantage to doing so? One answer to that question would be, look at the values that motivate people and towards which they orient their actions.
Very interesting. We'll dig into that a little bit more as we go on this hour. Let's take a look also at religions through history and their relationship to ethics. And Bob, I know that's something that you have studied. When we look at sort of ancient religions, the idea of one God is a relatively modern idea, but ethics with regard to religion, that's something that is as old as any recorded time.
That's true, Charity. And the reason for this is that from the ancient Near East, which, you know, most people are familiar in this country with what we call the Judeo-Christian ethic, or what we assume to be the Judeo-Christian ethic, In the ancient Near East, in ancient Mesopotamia, whether it be Babylonian, Assyrian, Egyptian, Persian, even at a later period, most of these, what we would call ethical codes or rules, the laws by which everyone must live, are said to be given by a deity. So when you look at the top of the Hammurabi stele, right, the Code of Hammurabi, the famous one, at the top of that, above all of the laws in the cuneiform there, you see a picture of Dinger Shamash, of the god Shamash, the sun god, handing down these rules, these laws to Nebuchadnezzar, right? To Hammurabi. And the idea is that the laws come from God. It's very difficult to say, I have a new law, we're going to make a change, socially it's going to affect you, and then to have that law stick. But if it comes from a deity, if it comes from a god who can punish you for things unseen and can punish you in the afterlife, potentially, then people are a little more hesitant to break this law. And so it's this idea that these social regulations come not from our response to others, from our interactions, from our understanding, an empathy with others, that, wow, I might not be treating you right. It's the belief that our social, our ethical norms, our morals, don't come from that exchange, but just come from on high. It's the assumption that that's what happens is what causes these ethics to remain fixed for such a long period of time.
When I think about, let's say, ancient Greece and the mythology and all of the many gods involved in that, that kind of invites the chicken or egg question of, you know, whether the principles that are outlined in all of these myths were something that come from the deities, or whether, you know, these myths were created to be a guide. These are your ethical guidelines.
Right. And this is something that has fascinated me, and that is that a lot of what we call the Judeo-Christian ethic is actually incorporation of earlier ethical laws, whether they be word for word from the Code of Hammurabi or whether they be the integration of Greek laws or Greek ideas, new, what we would call for them later ideas, that even though the stories may be false, even though the stories may be what we would call myth, they were made up, they can still contain a philosophical truth. And this is lost on some people, that a story can be told that can be completely made up, ahistorical, fictional, and yet can convey who we are as a people or what we believe to be right. And Jesus did this all the time with parables. Right? I don't think Jesus was a peeping Tom. I don't think that Jesus was looking in the window of the woman who lost one of her coins and was ripping her house apart and trying to find the coin. I think Jesus is making this story up, but he's telling this story to make a point that might be philosophically, morally, ethically true. So Jesus did this with parables, and a lot of the Greek myths, the ancient myths, were told to convey both what we believe to be right as a culture and who we are as a people.
And Webb, you've written quite a bit about sort of contrasting Christianity and Islam, both with each other, but also with other religions. And as you watch people make that transition to Christianity from a more traditional or an older, perhaps, belief system, I mean, what kind of contrast do you draw between this Christian worldview
and the earlier one?
Right.
Yeah. Well, The primary so if you look at Christianity and Islam from the position of the people that I was working with, they look much more alike each other than they seem different. This is, I think, consistent with something that Bob was saying. What both Christianity and Islam have in common is an attempt to create a cohesive, coherent, self-consistent code of moral law, where you essentially try to eliminate any kinds of internal contradictions. And in order to do that, both in theory and in practice, you need to have some point of view where you're essentially standing outside of yourself or standing outside of the flow of life in order to see all the different relationships you have and all the different kinds of activities you engage in from a single point of view. In other words, the way people live, in the pre-Christian society that I worked, You know, you have certain things that are right to do with your close kin, and then other ethics apply when you're dealing with very distant strangers. And you have things, even in our own lives, in sort of, you know, modern North America, you have often, you'll relate differently to your parents and to your colleagues at work and to strangers in the street and to people in very different countries. And this is actually probably the norm. This is probably the way most human life has been. Now, when you have a monotheistic religion like Christianity or Islam, it posits a what I call a third-person point of view or a God's eye point of view. That is to say, it teaches people to look at themselves from on high. I'm thinking of Bob mentioned the laws of Hammurabi being handed down from a deity. When you become absorbed this view of the world, this story about the world, it invites you to try to see your own life from the point of view of that deity. And when you see yourself from that far distance, for example, imagining yourself in the day of judgment, and you have to give an accounting of how your life is run, then you start to look, then it's only under those, from that very distant point of view, that you can start to see the inconsistencies or the apparent inconsistencies between how you treat your pet as opposed to the animal in the slaughterhouse, or your children as opposed to distant refugees, or your parents and a colleague at work. These inconsistencies start to become a problem that you want to iron out. This helps motivate what I call the code, the idea that you should have a morality that follows a single set of clear principles that are tightly organized.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment, and we will talk a great deal more about these ideas about morality and ethics and how they relate to religions and human behavior. With me this hour, Webb Keen, the George Herbert Mead Collegiate Professor of Anthropology at the University of Michigan. He's also the author of The Ethical Life, Its Natural and Social Histories. He'll be speaking at Grinnell College tonight. Robert Cargill is also here, Assistant Professor of Classics and Religious Studies. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about ethics and religion, asking some of the big questions about our ethical codes and how those codes do or do not play into different cultures around the world. With me, Webb Keen. He's the George Herbert Mead Collegiate Professor of Anthropology at the University of Michigan. He'll be speaking at Grinnell College tonight at 7:30 as part of a series on rethinking global cultures. He's also the author of Ethical Life, Its Natural and Social Histories. Robert Cargill is also here, Assistant Professor of Classics and Religious Studies at the University of Iowa. He's also the author of The Cities That Built the Bible. And just before the break, we were talking about the idea with these cultures that embrace monotheistic religions like Christianity and Islam. There's this idea of a third-party deity who imposes this moral code but is also judging us on the basis of our behavior. And Webb, you were talking about how then people who subscribe to these religions can examine themselves and think about how their behavior toward the people in their lives relates to that moral code or those ideas of that deity. And Robert, you wanted to weigh in on that and talk about the relationship idea here.
Right. Well, Professor Keen makes a brilliant point that there are laws in these ethical codes that are purely related to the deity, right? There are certain laws that we would say, we use the term victimless crimes, even though if you don't have a victim, it's hard to say you have a crime. But some people would say, yes, you do, because it's against the deity. So there are some regulations that are against the deity, right? Don't pick up sticks on the Sabbath, and you know, because this violates some code. But most of what we understand to be the ethical code that we're concerned about, the stuff that stays with us from generation to generation, are about these relationships. And Professor Keen made a good point. You interact with your family in a different way than you do with strangers or, you know, people in society, people in your city or your village. And then, of course, you interact with people that are in your village far differently than you do with the foreigner, with some other country or somebody from another religion. And it's where these two intersect. And it's the discrepancies, the contradictions between the way that we treat our closest of kin, what we're allowed to do and not allowed to do, the way we act and the way we don't act, and then the people in our village, and then the discrepancies between those who are like us, however you define that, and the foreigner. It's this liminal period. It's where these two intersect and overlap that we see a lot of these ethical problems. And when Professor Keene talks about this in ethical life, the problems with this overlap, with this these boundaries, that this is where we have a lot of the discussions, a lot of the problems with what we would consider competing or conflicting ethical codes.
Well, and Webb, of course, as people embrace religious ideas, different groups get to interpret these codes and these ideas in different ways. I mean, we certainly see a lot of that when we look at perhaps conflict between different Christian churches in the United States.
Mm-hmm. That's right, Charity. Of course, there are a lot of different moving parts happening all at once. But one of them is this, that the argument I would make is when you try to create a wholly consistent, coherent moral code, you run into certain kinds of problems. And there are at least two problems that I think produce conflict. There are all sorts of other political and social sources of conflict as well. But internal to the creation of a morality code, there are at least two basic problems. One of them is that there are just basic contradictions that are difficult and quite, I think, quite possibly impossible to get rid of between ethical instincts that are very, very deep in human beings. For example, the value of freedom and the value of equality, it's very hard to square those with each other because, as we see in sort of contemporary American life, if you value equality, it's often going to come at the price of some constraints on people's freedom to dominate or get ahead of others. If you value freedom, it's going to come at the expense of the value of equality. Can you have both values? I think Americans tend to value both, but it's very hard to value them both equally and have them not bump up against each other and cause conflict. The second problem with trying to create a wholly coherent, consistent moral code all the way through is that in order to do that, you basically – what the historical record shows is you basically have to upshift to a very highly abstract level of philosophical principles in order to override all of these contradictions that arise at the on-the-ground, everyday life level. But once you get up to that level of sort of high moral principles, they often become so abstract that it's hard to live them in practice. Because at the end of the day, none of this makes much sense if you can't actually live it, if you can't inhabit these moral codes in practical terms as a person who has to get through daily life on an ongoing basis. Very high, abstract, high-minded philosophical principles are great in principle, but they don't always offer very good guidance for, how am I going to live my life on a day-to-day basis?
You write a lot about ethical comparisons between different cultures in your book, and one of the really beautiful examples that you shared was from some field work that you were doing in a very remote part of Indonesia, comparing the marriage system there with the marriage system in the modern United States. Can you flesh out that example for us?
Sure. In the society I worked in is a society of clans. I think in a way it was not unlike, say, Scotland 1,000 years ago. Or Ireland. So people were parts of large clans, and your identity was very closely tied to that of the clan. So marriages were not a matter of one free, independent individual falling in love with another free, independent individual and following their heart and getting married, and that's the end of the story. A contract between two individuals. And in fact, that kind of marriage is historically extremely rare and quite late, even in European history. Rather, marriage is essentially a dynastic alliance between clans. When I get married, it's not just my business, it's the business of all the people around me. There are real consequences for sort of local relationships, local politics, all sorts of things are tied up in my marriage. And so clans have a huge say in who can and cannot marry one another. There's, in fact, the preference in this society is for a man to marry his first cousin on his mother's side, his mother's brother's daughter, or someone in that category of persons, so that you keep forming relationship with the same clan that your father did and his father before him. So you have an ongoing alliance between these two clans that is forged anew with each new marriage. And the clans get involved in negotiating the payments between the two sides, and they're very elaborate, and so forth and so on. Now, I studied this with great detail with people in the island of Sumba where I was living. And, of course, at one point, the old mother and the family that I'd become part of said, well, you know, enough about us. Let's hear about you folks. She said, so the Sumanese make payments. The bride side gives pigs and cloth to the groom side. The groom side gives horses and gold to the bride side. That's what makes a marriage valid, is the exchange of goods, and they're codified. So my Sumanese mother, she knows that different people have different customs. She's quite aware of this, and so she's curious. So how do your folks do it? She says, what do you folks pay? What kind of person are you supposed to marry? What kind of cousin are you supposed to marry? And what kind of payments do you make? And I said to her, well, you see, actually, we don't really make marriage payments to one another. And she sort of looked startled. And I said, but who are you supposed to marry? I said, well, actually, you marry whoever you want to. And she was shocked. She was really horrified. She said, you mean, you know, you just go around having sex like animals? This was just inconceivably animalistic to simply follow your desires and just marry whoever you felt like. She thought this was so profoundly lacking in morality as to be almost inconceivable. The Americans, when I tell Americans this story, they say, well, that's a terrible house to live because they don't have free choice in marriage.
Well, it's a beautiful example of two very different ethical codes, moral codes, two different people living in a way that they consider to be moral and ethical and that are completely at odds.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And of course, we run into those examples all the time in our cultures today. That's where we get a lot of conflict. I mean, we recently had, for example, the example in Europe with the whole controversy over the burkini. Mm-hmm. Women going to the beach in France, covering themselves fully in line with their own ethical, religious, moral beliefs. And then many people in France responding in a very negative way because they felt like it violated the principles of the nation.
Right, right. I mean, one of the truly tragic ironies of that whole situation is that the burkini was invented in order to allow women more freedom. That is to say, women who feel that modesty requires that they cover themselves, this enabled them to go to the beach. it was actually meant to be emancipating for them. Contemporary French like to be shocked by this, but they forget how their grandmothers and great-grandmothers used to dress when they went to the beach. My grandmother used to go to the beach dressed in this outfit that went all the way down to her ankles. I can assure you if someone walked across the University of Iowa or Grinnell campus in a bikini on campus, it might raise some eyebrows, because it's out of context, right? You expect to see a bikini on the beach, but maybe not in the classroom.
I'm talking this hour with Webb Keene. He's an anthropologist, the author of Ethical Life, Its Natural and Social Histories. He'll be speaking at Grinnell College tonight at 7:30. Robert Cargill, assistant professor of classics and religious studies at the University of Iowa and author of The Cities That Built the Bible. And, of course, these are questions all of us struggle with on almost a daily basis. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I have an email here from Todd in Iowa City, and he brings up kind of an interesting interdisciplinary question here, and I'd love to hear both of you, your thoughts on how different disciplines can study these same questions. But let's start with Todd's question. He says, how many of the behaviors that structure civilizations are, quote, neurally wired into the population at some specific proportion? For example, a society can operate with some X percentage of free riders or, quote, deviants beyond some threshold of functional social system begins to unravel. Clearly, as you're discussing, the overlay of religion can drive higher levels of stability through a punitive or reward-based system. Webb, I'd love to hear your response to that.
Well, this is part of an argument that requires, in order for the argument to really play out, you have to, I think, imagine that there's a functional goal in having a larger society. Because the argument, if I understand where he's coming from correctly, this is linked to an argument that has been made that you need big gods in order to have large-scale societies, because they enforce moral codes in ways that are consistent across a large-scale society. But then you might ask, well, but why should there be larger-scale societies? And there's a risk of circularity in making that kind of argument that I have not yet seen fully resolved. The argument I make in my book is that neurological wiring and cognitive psychology and so forth are raw materials that ethical systems work with, but that our basic natural endowments do not automatically produce ethics as such. That what we call ethics is something that is emergent over the course of social interaction. It's when people start to interact with one another and have to see themselves essentially through one another's point of view that it begins to produce forms of self-consciousness and forms of reflection that lead them to take advantage of their neurological and cognitive predispositions and wield them as tools or use them as tools for the construction of an ethical world.
Interesting.
So in other words, your cognition or your neurophysiology are not sufficient to produce ethics, but they are valuable raw materials that ethical systems then take advantage of.
Bob, you want to weigh in on
yeah,
that?
Yeah, and yet, you know, as this discussion over free will versus how much of what we do is actually our free will, and there's new research. This has been an age-old question, but and yet when we are coerced into doing something unethical in a court, that is usually a reason for, well, we're going to excuse this time. If you have a gun to your head and somebody forces you to do something, a jury will say, well, he was coerced, he was forced. And the same is true for hardwiring, especially with diseases or any kind of malady that one has. If someone commits a crime, but then it turns out that they have a massive tumor that was impairing the part of their head, a lot of juries would say, well, actually, he didn't want to do that. I think Professor Keene is right that these are the root causes of a lot of things. But the social ethic that we have is, what do we do with this? Since we are hardwired to a certain extent, and we don't know how much we are hardwired, and that these are taken on a case-by-case basis, and that there are some instances that what we are chemically, some people just have different chemical balances and it causes them to do certain things, and that our ethics actually vary based upon the intent or the motivation or the even coercion of the person committing this act. Those are part of our ethical dynamic.
And if I can piggyback on that, So I think Bob is absolutely right. And let me push that a little further and say one place you see variation is whether or not people are willing to claim that that tumor or that chemical imbalance is me. So you actually see variation in people's willingness to identify with what is being with the say biological causes that produce certain effects, and that is something that you can learn or unlearn to identify yourself with that. But you know, when the tumor makes me, the brain tumor leads me to act in certain ways, I can disavow that. I can say that was not me.
Right. Mm-hmm. We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me, anthropologist Webb Keene. He's the author of Ethical Life, Its Natural and Social Histories, and Robert Cargill, author of The Cities That Built the Bible. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about morality and religion. With me, Webb Keene, the George Herbert Mead Collegiate Professor of Anthropology at the University of Michigan and the author of Ethical Life, Its Natural and Social Histories. He'll be speaking at Grinnell College tonight at 7:30 as part of a series on rethinking global cultures. Robert Cargill is also here, Assistant Professor of Classics and Religious Studies at the University of Iowa and author of The Cities That Built the Bible. You are welcome to join the conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we've got Jim on the line in Dubuque. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi. What's your thought today?
Well, my thought is from a Mad Magazine strip from almost 40 years ago. And this is during the time when there were singles-only apartment buildings in the bigger cities. And the strip starts out with a young woman coming out to the swimming pool in a bikini, a tiny one, and striding along, and none of the guys are paying any attention to her. She says to her friend in the pool, gee, thanks for letting me borrow your swimsuit. And the friend says, where did you get that? And the woman continues to preen, throw her hair back, and she says, oh, top drawer on the right. And the friend in the pool says, well, that's not a swimsuit, that's underwear. And the woman shrieks, underwear, and every guy's head snaps around immediately. Haven't paid attention to her before, but snaps around immediately. And she runs shrieking back into the building. So, again, it is, as you said, context.
Absolutely. Well, Jim, thank you so much.
Context is everything.
That's right.
Right, absolutely. Well, and it also, again, it's a great example of how we impose sometimes not necessarily rational codes onto ourselves. And, you know, in your book, Webb, you write quite a bit about the different places that people believe moral codes come from. And I'd love to explore that a little bit in the last part of the show today, because there are many people who do believe that our moral codes or our morality comes from a divine place, and that you can't have a moral culture without religion. There are many other people who believe that it comes from the laws or the structure of your society, and many others that believe that it's part of being human. It's part of just being a rational human being that you develop this moral code. And you explore some of those ideas. I'm curious about, from all of the cultures that you've observed and studied, do you feel like a moral code that comes from a religious tradition, do you see that as something that's stronger than something that maybe comes out of a rational or a reasoning?
Well, the advantage, you know, Bob, I think, already sort of pointed towards this in his comments earlier. The advantage of a religious moral code is that it has, could be more stable than other kinds. If you have a strong sense of reinforcement, possibly of divine punishment, of fear of an afterlife, and so forth, and perhaps even more importantly, if it's something that is cognitively available. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you've got the Ten Commandments, you can teach those to a kid. They're easy to memorize. They're easy to keep in mind. So they have a law-like character to them. They're relatively clear-cut and so forth. You go into Deuteronomy and Leviticus, you still have clear-cut, explicit laws. They're a little harder to keep track of because they're so complicated. But these do tend to create both stability, both at the on-the-ground level, in terms of people's cognition, and at a larger social level, because they tend to get woven through all sorts of enforcement mechanisms, priesthoods, legal systems, school systems, and ritual systems. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, this can lead to a sense of alienation from the moral code as well, when it comes to be seen something that you don't have ownership over, that's imposed on you from outside, that is so tightly constructed that it leaves you no freedom of action, and may even present you with impossible contradictions. Situations where you cannot, in fact, do the right thing without also contradicting some other moral principle. So it is no accident that religious history is full of turmoil, constant reformation movements and revival movements, where people, when people come to feel that the moral codes are too distant from them or too alien from them, that they really do come from outer space and they're impossible to take ownership of or to feel an identification with, they rebel and they create reformations or they rebel altogether into another religion or into no religion at all. So there are advantages and disadvantages viewed from a functional point of view,
Bob?
To a moral code with a divine source.
Right. Sure, and the reason that religious moral codes are so popular is it provides this sense, maybe a false sense, but a sense of objective morality. That is, just tell me what's right and what's wrong. The problem with this is that moral codes, ethical codes, evolve with the people that they are to govern. And we see that the problem occurs when a society evolves. Let's say we abolish slavery. And yet this fixed moral code from a couple thousand years ago says that not only does God show you how to make a slave and who to be a slave and who can be a slave and how to regulate the slaves, and the New Testament comes along and far from a I have a dream speech, right? It's slaves obey your masters, slaves obey. It reinforces this. Now you've got this problem that the moral code is 2,000 years old when slavery was the norm, and now we live in a society that this is aberrant, right? This is not what we can do. And so what people do is they make this claim, well, in its context, this was okay. The problem with appealing to context is it eliminates any idea of objective moral code. What you're doing when you invoke context is you're saying it was subjective based on the context of the time. So it nullifies this notion that a religious code is objective as soon as you don't follow the code as it's written. And this, again, demonstrates one of the problems that we have in society today is that most fundamentalists – and of any religion, don't realize they're fundamentalists. That is, they were just raised in their culture, in their family, in their clan, in their society with whatever this book says is the objective moral truth. You have to follow it. And so when that, what they've been taught, this ancient objective code, doesn't match, it doesn't feel right based on society, that's where the dilemma comes in.
We have this comment from Stephanie in Cedar Rapids. She says, as a non-believer, I feel that morals arise from a general communal understanding of keeping the peace in one's community. After all, it's not as though rampant murdering and violence are tolerated within most animal communities, and they're certainly not attending any sort of church. It just makes sense to keep things calm, and often keeping that calm involves meeting out some sort of agreed-on punishment for various infractions. I understand that some people take great comfort from their religions, and I don't fault them for that. But as a society, we don't necessarily require an omnipotent parent figure to ensure that we behave reasonably toward each other. Secular laws do a good enough job of keeping miscreants in line and have done so for millennia. And her point of view is one that a lot of people share, but as both of you are pointing out, there are many, many religious people in the world, in the United States and all around the world. And Webb, you think it's very important that we understand that religion is important to many people, right?
Yes. So let me first just say, I want to agree with Stephanie that you do not need to have a religion in order to be a moral or ethical person. And this is it's extremely important to understand this. And one of the I have a chapter in my book that's devoted to, in fact, revolutionaries, political revolutionaries, who I argue were driven by ethical values to essentially care for, educated, comfortable people who cared so much about the condition of the peasants that they fostered revolution on behalf of peasants whose condition had no effects on them directly. Namely, they were driven by altruistic values without any religious basis. In fact, they were explicitly atheists. So I want to just concur with Stephanie's point that although moral codes are closely associated with religion in much of the world today, there is no necessary religious basis for ethics. Having said that, it is extremely important that we understand that humans are highly prone to religion and to living religious lives and having and producing religious worlds around them, and we have to take that seriously, and we have to take that respectfully. Now, I speak as an anthropologist, so that's my professional duty, but I also think that it should just be a basic precept. There is no evidence that religion is going to go away. And I think that's probably for good reasons having to do with the way humans live their lives. I don't have the answer to all of those. I can't tell you definitively why that is, but I think one part of it is that, as I was saying earlier, it helps to have some kind of concrete, particular guidance and good stories to make it understandable and credible, and stories that you can share within your community to help teach the practices and values that at some level are going to have to be driven not by high-minded principles, but by gut feelings. And how do you get those gut feelings? Well, in part from the practices and stories that have been around you all your life. A lot of those come out of religion. Not necessarily, but it is one source.
And I think it's also important to remember that not all confessional peoples, not all religious individuals are fundamentalists. And that is, there's a great spectrum, a continuum of those who argue that we have to interpret the Bible or the Quran as it is written versus those who acknowledge that society has changed and therefore our laws have changed and our religious understanding has changed. And it's this idea of the interpretation of the law. We hear this all the time, interpretation of the 9/10 of the law. The same goes for religion. There are religious denominations that are far more progressive, far more accommodating, far more evolved, if you will, and there are those that are fundamentalists. And I think we shouldn't pigeonhole all people of faith as fundamentalists,
right,
but understand that there are many very, very ethical, progressive Christians.
And Webb, I know you've also pointed out in your writing that there are larger gulfs between different kinds of practicing Christians or different kinds of practicing Muslims than there are between, say, Christianity and Islam as a whole. And I want to get to the phones because there are a lot of people who want to be a part of this conversation. Bonte is on the line. Hi, Bonte.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question? Quickly.
Well, it's less of a question, but most of the discussion has been from the Abrahamic religious perspective. And I'm Bonte Dhammapala. I'm a Buddhist monk. And I'm wondering if your guests could speak to ethics from a non-theistic perspective, specifically the Buddhist.
Sure, Webb, do you want to respond to that?
Well, I think that's a really I'm actually glad you brought that up, because it is true that in fact there is a strong bias in American conversations about religion to think in Abrahamic terms. So it's extremely important to bear in mind the huge spectrum of possibilities that are out there. I am not a specialist in Buddhism, but one of my understandings is that there is that Buddhist practices do teach and do inculcate what I call the third person point of view, which is to see your life in the context of a much larger, sort of vast, the context in which you situate yourself is vast, and that may or may not require a monotheistic deity, but it certainly requires a point of view that has the God's eye point of view quality to it. In other words, seeing yourself from a distance. And I don't know if that's consistent with your own experience as a Buddhist monk, but I think that has to be part of the story. And in that respect, Buddhism shares certain characteristic features with the Abrahamic religions.
Sure. And in religious traditions, I mean, I'm teaching my religions in a global context course in the spring. And in religious traditions that don't necessarily have a deity, a lot of the Asian religious traditions, the idea is that the gods can't do anything to affect us, or they don't do anything. They don't have a card in this game, right? They're not betting for or against humanity. So that the idea is that humanity must figure out for itself how best to relate both to each other and to nature. That is, how do we go through nature? How do we go through life as human beings in a manner that over the long term benefits us as humans and that helps us relate to our fellow human beings? I mean, if that is the center of it, then in one regard, you could say that this is the continually evolving ethic. And that is, as new dynamics come into the human experience, as new natural phenomena, as the earth changes, as people migrate, as people move, that ethic should and will change with it for the best. That is, we're always struggling to find out how to relate to our fellow humans the best we can.
Well, and we have just 1 minute left. And Webb, I'd love to hear your very quick thoughts as we go. You know, we've been talking about this in a personal perspective, thinking about our own morality and morality of different religions and communities. But in the context of today's world, I mean, these are very important questions to be asking as a culture, aren't they?
They certainly are. And you know, I want to reinforce what Bob was saying, that the whole business is an ongoing, constantly changing, learning new things about the world we live in and the people around us and new ways to relate to them. And this, the idea that ethics has to be a fixed objective, you know, rock-like thing, I think is a mistake. But the fact that it's evolving does not mean that it's real. Does not mean that it's not real and not serious. It is real, it's serious, but it grows.
Webb Keene, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Robert Cargill, thank you.
Good to be here.
Robert Cargill, Assistant Professor of Classics and Religious Studies at the University of Iowa, author of The Cities That Built the Bible. Webb Keene is the George Herbert Mead Collegiate Professor of Anthropology at the University of Michigan and the author of Ethical Life, Its Natural and Social Histories. He's speaking tonight at 7:30 at Grinnell College. This is Talk of Iowa.